Welcome to the Mac Observer's Daily Observations podcast. I'm Jeff Gamet. Today is Tuesday, December 16th, 2014. And with me today, I have my own legal representation, Brian Chaffin. How are you?
You are in trouble, sir.
Well, I'm hoping that I can use that during appeal. And
You're in trouble.
Yeah. Well, sometimes these life choices we make become important life lessons. Yeah. And speaking of life choices, John Martellaro, how are you?
Good morning. A man of modest opinions.
I was thinking a man of international mystery.
Oh, that too. Absolutely. Let me get my glass of scotch here.
Yes, it's after.
Well, it's a bit early. It's a bit early in the morning, though.
It's afternoon somewhere. Yeah. All right. Well, now that we've established the drinking schedule, I thought we could dive in a little bit or a lot into the appeal that Apple argued yesterday or presented yesterday in the iBook antitrust trial. And Brian, you wrote this up.
Yeah, so we had the hearing. It's an appeals hearing in front of
a three-judge panel.
Three-judge panel, not the full circuit panel, but that which is how these things usually go, in front of a subsection of the full circuit court. And I tell you, because it's all about me, I was extremely gratified to see at least one of the judges looking at this case the way I've been looking at it for a couple of years. It was, you know, in that it was just so, you know, it was so mystifying. And I think it was so mystifying for all three of us to see Judge Denise Coate, who is the district court judge, the normal federal judge, who convicted Apple of antitrust violations with the horror, you know, in being the ringleader of a price fixing scheme with publishers in a market that was controlled by a monopolist who was engaging in predatory pricing.
I was stymied. The verdict that she issued or rendered just simply didn't make sense to me.
Didn't make sense. It didn't make sense from following along from the evidence that was presented. I mean, to me, reading through the DOJ's evidence and reading through the DOJ's own timeline completely countered their own arguments. The whole case was just mystifying. And Apple, of course, has vowed immediately to appeal. We know that Apple was very angry about the conviction. Apple's top leadership didn't think that they had done anything wrong, that they hadn't broken the law. And getting in front of this three-judge panel gives us a hint that the judges may actually see it Apple's way, at least two of them.
That's kind of how it looks, yeah.
Now, it's always dangerous making too much, trying to read too much in judges' questioning.
Why is that, Brian?
Because in an appeals case or at the Supreme Court level, a judge. So what happens is these are limited hearings. So like 80 minutes was the hearing for this particular case, and the both sides get an attorney to present their case of why it should either the original decision should be upheld or why the original decision should be overturned, and then judges ask them questions if they want to, and they may be pushing against an attorney because they disagree with that attorney or they don't like the arguments that they heard. Or they may be pushing against an attorney because they want to make sure that that those arguments hold water. You know, they're looking for holes and they just, you know, in a sense, playing devil's advocate. And you don't know until the verdict is actually handed down.
Trying to understand if the position is articulated and solid and strong, and force them to say it in a way that makes their case clearly and sort of helps articulate the situation, right?
Absolutely, absolutely. And in this case, though, we had some rather strong and clear language that suggested at least one of the judges, Judge Dennis Jacobs, that he, in fact, truly is mystified by the DOJ even bringing this case against Apple. He used the word monopolist and monopoly to describe Amazon, the company that had 90% market share in the ebook market when Apple came along as a new entrant.
And under the circumstances, that is very strong word choice.
It is. And, of course, Amazon is not a convicted monopolist. Amazon was not on trial, which is actually the problem here in the first place. But he used the term monopolist to describe them. He used the term predatory pricing to refer to their practice of dumping books below cost to extend their market share.
I found that to be fascinating too.
Yeah, yeah, because that actually would be illegal behavior.
Well, I have a theory about that, Brian.
Do tell.
Well, I think in older times when there wasn't so much going on, the weight of precedent was more on our minds because we weren't flooded with information. The number of cases wasn't so great, but we're on the exponential rise, the exponential curve of everything. And so my theory is that the DOJ was a little bit inexperienced and has been overwhelmed with information. When that happens, the weight and the reflection upon precedent isn't so immediate on the mind. And I think they just lost track of the fact that it's a historical thing in this country for rich, powerful companies to lose money trying to squeeze competitors out of the marketplace by force. And I just think they lost sight of that and the misapplied value of that in unethical behavior of that practice, and perhaps the weight of history kind of fell away, and they didn't feel like that was something to be concerned about anymore because the weight of history and all those things that has happened in the past wasn't immediately in their legal minds.
Well, we know that Amazon was singing in the DOJ's ear for some time before the case was filed.
Oh, that too. Yeah.
And, you know, and we also know that the Apple was not. And it's funny, one of the most interesting things was when one of the judges, Judge Lohier, who also appears to be sympathetic to Apple, but again, you know, dangerous reading too much into that. But he asked the DOJ's attorney how Apple and the publishers could have broken Amazon's monopoly. There's that word again. Right? Two judges used monopoly to describe Amazon, right? But he asked how they could have broken Amazon's monopoly without breaking antitrust law. And the attorney said that I'm looking for the exact quote here, but basically said, well, you know, Apple, they could have filed their own lawsuit.
Huh.
Which to me sounds a lot like, well, we sued Apple, the publishers, because there were four of the big five publishers were also accused of this price fixing scheme, and the publishers all settled before it went to trial. But it sounds like he's saying that they were sued simply because they hadn't already sued, which is really
kind of
awful.
Crazy.
Yeah, that's just bad law practice there.
So, John, you had an idea that maybe the DOJ had lost sight of some things, and then that led to the lawsuit. I'm wondering if part of this was a very public, high-profile power play on the part of the DOJ, where they felt that they needed to flex their muscles and show that that they were still in control of many aspects of the market, and so they chose this as their showcase fight because it would be high profile, and they felt that they could win. Ultimately, they did, and in the end, I have a feeling if it doesn't completely backfire on them, it will at least partially backfire, because my Jedi instincts are telling me that the appeals court, at a minimum, is going to hand the case back down to the lower courts if they don't just toss it out completely.
Well, one of the things that that Apple's attorneys were arguing is that Judge Coates used the wrong standard to decide the case. She used the per se illegal standard, which is price fixing is illegal, therefore it's bad, the end. And Apple argued that a different standard should have been made. And this argument apparently found appeared to find sympathy with the two judges, and that the other standard is that it's called the rule of reason standard, which effectively means that you actually apply a little logic to the situation. And in this case, horizontal price fixing is better than monopolist.
Sure. And it seems to me that logic in this case is an appropriate measure to apply, because if you go simply based on Judge Coates' reasoning or apparent reasoning, you end up with a scenario where you have the government giving indirectly its support for a monopoly to use whatever tactics it wants, essentially, to maintain market control.
Yeah, it's true.
In this case, that would be Amazon being given the opportunity to just do as they please. And we've seen that happening already with the way that they strong-armed Hatchet into tried to changing their book prices.
Well, you know, I'm very encouraged by this news, because as we followed the case before, I always felt like Judge Coates had it in for Apple. And it seemed to me, as an amateur in this area, that no matter what Apple did, Apple couldn't win. And Coates wasn't doing the things that would be a signature of a fair and balanced approach to both sides of this. And this appeals court appears to be taking the approach that, you know, there were possibly some political bias in this previous finding, which we all kind of thought intuitively was going on anyway.
Well, you know, it's interesting. Judge Coates herself, I would like to iterate. This actually would count as a reiteration, because I have said it many times. Judge Coates is an accomplished jurist with an impressive track record as a district court judge. Compared to Judge Lucy Koh, who is the judge who oversaw the big patent battles between Apple and Samsung, who was a new judge and seemed to make just a ton of mistakes. But Judge Coates, the judge who oversaw the antitrust case against Apple, is not – she is a smart jurist, and it does seem like she brought a lot of biases into the case. I mean, she herself said in her own ruling, and I'm paraphrasing here, but she essentially said that anytime Apple offered up a counter argument against the DOJ's witnesses, they just didn't have any credibility. So, you know, just, you know, so Apple.
That's an interesting word to use, Brian. You might say that it was without legal merit. You might say that it was illogical. You might say it was unfounded or inappropriate. But to use that language suggests bias to me as well.
Yeah. Well, and the fact that she, I mean, that hasn't seemed to come up in this case, in this appeals hearing.
Saying somebody's argument is not credible is an emotional response, is it not? It's not a technical response.
Yeah. So, you know, but what do you do? So you're the jury, or in this case, the judge, because this case was not in front of a jury. It was decided by Judge Coate. You're being told, two parties. One party says this is the way it happened, and the other party says no, this is the way it happened. You have to make a judgment call. You know, one side or the other is wrong, and one side or the other is right. And obviously, there will be shades of gray sometimes. But in her case, every time Apple disproved what the DOJ's attorneys were saying, she just didn't find it credible. The end. You know, that was part of why when, you know, we were looking at all the evidence.
Well, that's what raised my hackles, was because Apple's lawyers are smart. They're very experienced and well paid, and Apple hires very experienced attorneys who are astute and well prepared. And so for an Apple attorney to come in with what we think is a very sound and very astute and very legally compelling argument, and to be told, you know, go sit in the corner, yeah, you're not credible, it kind of made me wonder.
Well, this was actually Eddie Q's testimony. And in particular, like one of the things was that the DOJ held up an email and showed where Steve Jobs had said something to another Apple executive that looked very damning. And then Apple turned around and showed that was a draft email. That particular draft was never sent, and right. that's not at all the actual conversation that ended up taking place. And
isn't it against legal precedent to convict somebody for what they're thinking? Freedom of conscience is sacred, yeah, so right?
But if she didn't find the testifier credible, then that means that Apple didn't disprove it.
Right. And so this all plays into your observation, Brian, that you have made on many occasions, which is that the actions will seem unreasonable or irrational because of a key missing piece of information that we don't have. So I have to believe that with Judge Coate's reputation, that there was something else in all of this that we as bloggers in the media and the general public were not privy to. And that played into her ruling. But the appeals court is not buying into whatever that was.
Yeah, well, they're not buying into to the circumstances. You know, I wonder with Judge Coate. Judge Coate is her district court is in Manhattan. She ends up seeing a lot of publishing cases. I wonder if she just knows the publishers all too well, and that she's all too willing to assume that they were in fact conspiring to fix prices. That's where the per se illegal legal standard comes in, because if what the publishers were doing was illegal, then Apple participating in it makes it becomes illegal too. Right, that's the per se illegal standard. So if you know, that could well be the missing piece of information. She just knows the publishers all too well.
All right, that seems like the most plausible explanation I've heard so far. So that's awesome. Thank you for coming up with that.
There's a one more thing. The judge, this is Judge Jacob again. He actually cracked jokes at the DOJ's expense, and he did so on a couple of occasions. And that's never a good sign for your side.
No,
not at all.
No.
Like he apparently the DOJ's attorney tried to paint the picture that Apple was like the driver who was delivering narcotics to a drug deal. And the judge cracked that's one industry where we tend to take a little we tend to take a dim view on new entrants to the market.
That is an incredibly elegant way to smack down the DOJ's attorneys.
Dripping with wit and sarcasm and experience.
And his other joke was that all those people who got together referring to Apple and the publishers, it's like the mice saying they want to put a bell on the cat. This is another line that got laughs in the court. Again, not a good sign for the DOJ side.
No, not at all. So, hey, we're out of time, which means that we have to wrap up.
Bummer.
I know. I am hopeful that the appeals court will have a different outlook on this this case than Judge Coate did, but I'm not going to hold my breath because it's the legal system. You never know what's going to happen in the end.
And it's going to take months.
Do you know, Jeff, when a decision is due?
Months.
Yeah, it'll probably be several months before we hear anything.
As many as six.
Oh, my.
Yeah. So, of course, we will be revisiting this at some point in the future. We just don't know exactly when. So, Brian, thank you for joining me today.
Thanks for having me.
Yeah. And, John, thank you for being here. I always enjoy having you here, too.
You're very welcome.
And to all of our listeners, thank you for being here. And head over to the iTunes store and rate the show for us, because it's always great getting your feedback. And thanks for interacting with us online, too. Really appreciate it. We'll see everyone tomorrow.
Bye-bye.